Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm also the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts here in Norwood. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, kickboxing, and we will help you get in touch with your inner badass. So just reach out to us. And I'm here, as always, with my host, Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
I'm feeling pretty good today, John.
7.1?
A solid 7.
Solid 7.
I scale 1 to 10.
Solid
I go 7.
Huh.
That's pretty good.
That's good. Dan, we have a special guest today. I'm going to give him, I'm going to try to remember all your bona fides, Mark. So he was my college roommate, which is pretty impressive.
Is that freshman year?
Same bunk the senior year.
Sophomore to senior. Were you the same bunk?
Top and bottom, yeah.
Good grief.
Does that mean that you selected each other as roommates since
we did.
You started sophomore year?
Yeah, we did. All Ivy tailback, right, at Harvard. Mm-hmm. He won, like, the Harvard Football Award, too. What is that award?
Oh, I forget what his name. It's basically the
All
MP,
those head
MVP.
Injuries are kicking in now.
Yeah. I was happy because the team votes it, the players.
Oh, nice.
So the player for the year. So
Mr. Mark Vignali, and he's also a teacher.
Three golden helmets.
Three golden helmets.
Because I got concussed for two of those. That's why I like to mention it. Because they were concussed.
So it was a golden helmet just for play? Like just means you're...
It's like player of the week in New England. One against Army, one against Dartmouth, and one Princeton.
Nice. Mark's also a school teacher, filmmaker.
And teach meditative practice.
Yeah.
Ongoing, yeah. Workshops.
It's like a spiritual guru, basically. Dan is also a guru.
Okay. And John's opinion. I'm sure anyone else...
And Mark's it, yeah.
Mom, my wife calls me Loco Guru.
Loco Guru. I didn't know that. That's pretty good.
So I'm the Loco Guru.
Loco Guru.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
No, I got nothing. That's
So she told me not to say that outside of the living room.
Keep it in the house.
but this is fun because it's the first shout out for the movie, John. We're doing a film on Connors
MMA.
That's
what I was going to say. That's really why he's in, is the filmmaking.
It's the first actual little promote.
Right.
Yeah. Because we're 90% through the footage. So that's a big deal for us. So
this isn't a secret, is it?
No.
Okay.
So, no,
but I don't think most people know about this, even in the gym.
Oh, maybe not.
Right. Just unless you've been there. We come every 3 or 4 months for the last 2 years. So if you've been in the gym that weekend, then you'll know that we're filming you and we filmed Tyler in Japan. And we got probably 8 fights at Cage Titan down at Plymouth. Shout out to them.
Yep.
And Jesse's a part of it. Rory, John Burke.
Been to
Leo,
some jiu-jitsu events too.
Become part of the story, you know, of Connors MMA.
The subject is Connors MMA, or is there, you know, do you have a pre-thought theme of the film, or is it just we're following and you're going to see what story evolves?
Well, yeah, story's evolving. We're following John. Basically, my partner, Zoran Omar, who I've worked on a film with before, he came to me, said he had an idea for a documentary. He thought I could help him. He said, do you know anybody who's successful in an unorthodox way? Because he was, you know, wanted to move past people thinking of success as the big rich guys, you know, and the big executives or whatever, or a big athlete, you know, great LeBron James, just successful in an unorthodox way. And I immediately thought of John.
And I'm guessing at Harvard, the people who had some sort of business success, they're a dime a dozen.
Exactly. We have, right. Yeah, just guys who've banked $100 million in their 20s and retired. We know guys who ran for governor, the guy in Minnesota, guys are worth hundreds of millions of dollars now. But John just popped up to me, said, I was in the classroom.
Dan, I'm worth hundreds.
You're like, I would take that maybe over the unorthodox success. Maybe
should have went the more orthodox route.
Damn it. That's funny. But see, John and I, when I was teaching in the classroom, I would call him often, and we would end up talking about teaching methods and just philosophy. If you know John, people who have known him from the academy, he has a philosopher's mind, and he's a real teacher, so he loves to integrate information, process it, and kind of make it his own, and techniques for his students, and why do people learn? How do they learn behavior, things around fighting, and what makes a guy rebound after a loss? How do you rebound after a loss? The mental piece that goes into fighting, and all that was so intriguing to me. I always was able to apply our talks to my classroom, and so it just always left an impression on me whenever John and I talk. And
if you don't mind me, I don't know if I'm breaking in, but like, and this might be tough, but can you think of an example? Because I'm curious of like, it might sound strange to be like, John, you know, coaching a fighter and you saying you're applying a principle to mm-hmm. a classroom. Mm-hmm. Like, can you give an example of that? Or
yeah,
the how
one
it translates?
The one that pops up first is the idea of comfort zone, that we all have a comfort zone. And you don't really learn until you stretch outside of your comfort zone and you apply a little pressure to yourself and put a little tension into the learning process. Force yourself to learn something that you weren't sure you were capable of. So you're always pushing a boundary. And that actually applies to a teaching principle called the zone of proximal development, developed by a guy named Zygotsky, a Russian educationalist who basically discovered that, yes, there's a zone of development where you have to, as a teacher, lead your student into. It's like the little uncomfortable water. It's a little deeper than he's used to, and he's going to flounder around out there, and you got to really watch him, because if you give him too much too fast, they panic and they can just totally collapse. But if you give them just enough where they can handle the tension, but they're feeling the tension, that's the zone where you're really growing. And in that zone, you're actually, the tension comes because you're giving them new information and they have to discard the old information as they readjust to what they're learning. So there's a point of tension. And Zahn talks about the comfort zone a lot, trying to get guys outside of their comfort zone. Make it a practice to push yourself out of your comfort zone. And that's how you always stretch and grow and keep evolving.
We've talked about it in different contexts here quite a few times because people resist it.
You don't want to leave the comfort zone. You'd rather sit on your couch.
I'm on a podcast where we talk about it, and then I still can't always do it. Like sometimes I'm like, I don't want to get off the couch, and I don't want to take the cold shower. I don't want to go into the gym and be crushed by people. I don't want to do a lot of things that are uncomfortable.
Every time you step in the gym, it's a comfort zone expansion, really, you know, if you're out there pushing yourself.
And then I recently talked, not to bring it to, momentarily back to the gym, but I had been training very, very casually and loosely for a while. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And I don't think it was a mistake, but I recently told John that I want to be a little more uncomfortable in the gym. I want to try a little harder. I'd been training very friendly. You know, just like if anyone has me in anything, I'll just tap real quick. I'll laugh and I'll go. And I was like, I want to train just a little less friendly.
Dan has a disarming sense of humor and it's very effective. You know what I mean? And it's witty. So he was rolling with me and he says something like, you know, maybe I did something and got an advantage on him. And he'll make some funny remark like, now I got you. Like, this is exactly what I wanted. And it's when you both laugh and it's disarming, but it's something about it that's making the situation more comfortable, not uncomfortable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm going to quit on that totally. Like, it's a spectrum. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, so Marcelo, for the last, as people are getting ready to compete, he's saying, like, let's not talk like we're friends for 3 weeks or whatever it is. Like, let's compete all out and no one's friends and no one's laughing and no one's talking. And I haven't even totally done it. But right. I get what he means. Like, there's growth to be had in being uncomfortable and being like, we're not just laughing and playing in here. Because then when you go to compete, they're not laughing and playing.
Yeah, as a teacher, with a student who is doing what you're doing, I'd say it's a defense mechanism because you don't want to go there. You kind of don't want to, like, just be a total abandon and get pushed to that wall where you may lose, or you may actually get tapped, choked out. You know, it's
right. It makes losing too. Like, it's just, you're just joking around.
You weren't
just
really trying.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. It gives you that ego trap. It actually gives you a way to say later, I wasn't really trying. I wasn't, you know.
And there's space for it. Like, and I may in the future feel like I just want to have fun on the mat. I don't really want to do this. But I think you at least need to intersperse it a little with a little more discomfort and a little more meanness.
Yeah, because you learn. That's how you learn. Advance.
And on the offensive, I'm not letting things go as quick as I used to. Like, you know, if someone say a white belt, and I had something, I would let it go. Now I'm going to tap them because I'm like, I want to play a little meaner for a little while. I'm not saying forever.
But that's how you develop your game. So, Mark, in jiu-jitsu, a lot of your development comes when you're sparring with a partner who has less experience and less skill than you, and maybe physically not as strong. So then you can innovate. You can bring in your new offense and develop your new offensive tools that you wouldn't be able to do against somebody that was on par mm-hmm. with you or better than you. So that's an important amount of training that if you don't do that, you're never, it'd be like never shooting the ball in basketball.
Right. That's how you're getting through your reps. Right.
Yeah.
And you hear people say like, oh, the best thing would be, it's awesome to just roll with all black belts, all awesome competitors, but it's not true because then nothing ever works. You know, nothing you do ever works.
Your defense will probably improve, but
it'd be like trying to learn basketball and be like, it'd just be great if you could play against NBA All-Star team, but it might not help you at all because you're like, I can't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I try to move, they steal the ball. I try to shoot, they block it. I try, you know, I can't stop them. I can't do it. You couldn't learn.
Then you're in that, what you're talking about, that the way I call it is your comfort zone. Your challenge zone is what I call it, is that zone of
proximal development.
Proximal development. And then beyond that, I call it the overwhelm zone. Then you're getting overwhelmed. Right. And then that's where learned helplessness happens and things like that, where you're like, ish, none of this works anyways. Why bother to try to shoot? They're just going to block it. So you actually get a negative learning.
Right. Or in jiu-jitsu, someone gets on top of you and you're like, I can't get out.
Right.
You know, you try and try and try. And if you try for 2 months and you could never get out, then you think, I can't get out. And they get on you and you're like, I'm just going to rest. I'm not even going to try.
Know. Yeah.
You have to really balance that as a teacher, because you have to give them both. Because it's like you have to be with the better at some point to push, but you have to go through a lot of the reps with the guys who are just a little bit.
Well, in that challenge zone is unique to every individual, and it changes on a daily basis. You know what I mean? It's how they're feeling. So it's very subjective. And some people have a pretty broad challenge zone where they can get crushed, and for a while they don't really get discouraged. And other people, it's a little bit more narrow. Like they're going to get discouraged easily.
There's people that come into the gym for one day and never come back, right?
Yeah.
So you got to match people up with these things in mind. Sometimes you have to say, you got to go with him today, or no, I would just go with him today.
Yeah. Mark, I think that's very important. In the past, old school, you would have a training partner, and then we're going to spar live. I would line up, I would do a round with him, the bell would ring, we would stop, we'd line back up again, and everyone would take a step to the left. And it was like Russian roulette. You didn't know who the hell you were going to get. And it was very stressful. I remember, you know, it's very common for people to be like looking down the line, calculating, oh, I'm going to get Thuggo 3 rounds from now.
Right.
I better save my energy because he's going to crush me. And it's just distracting. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In my academy, for the most part, I say, Dan, you're going to go with him, and you're going to go. And I put people with, so I know they're going to have the most positive experience. They're going to get the most development out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not necessarily iron sharpens iron, you know.
Yeah, that's like when I was teaching. If you had math, if you had a guy better at math than this other one, sometimes it's good to put them together. He's going to learn by teaching the other one, and the other one's going to learn by trying to match this guy because he's a peer. He's going to listen a little more intensely. So he's going to come up, and the other guy's just going to practice what he knows and deepen it just by going through it, you know, and through instructing somebody else. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a delicate balance.
So to get back to this film, Dan, it's been an amazing experience for 2 years, right? If not longer.
Yeah, 2 years.
I don't know too much about it as much as
we don't know anything about it either.
I don't even know. May in 2017, we started. Zoran liked the project. We got a spec of John, and he looked good on camera, so we said, okay. And then we just started coming filming, and it just worked out that he had Cage Titan fights in the fall, and then that's why we'd come a couple, both Novembers, and then things happened in the spring, we'd come back, and then the story develops, lines have just evolved naturally. It's almost like a diary entry, the year in the life of John, 2 years in the life of John, really.
But Dan, there's a certain pressure to be interesting.
So let's back up to one thing. First of all, you say John looked good on camera.
Yeah, he looks good on camera. He's got presence.
Yeah.
He's got camera. Not everybody looks good on presence. His big head works to his advantage.
That's right.
On camera.
Like most movie stars have abnormally large head.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that true?
It's sure. True. You go to Hollywood, it looks like a bunch of bobblehead dolls.
Did it get outside of the gym at all to John's personal life?
A little bit, as things came up and it became integrated.
Because you've had some big ups and downs in your personal life.
Yeah,
now, too.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, yeah, we captured as much as we could. And you always want to make a story as personal as you can so people relate to it. And looking at it, we want to make this that fighters and people who like fighting, we're going to enjoy it. My own personal goal, they say, what's your audience? What's your basic audience? Our base audience are fight nerds. There's a great line that Tyler King has where we're interviewing him and saying, how did you get involved in fighting? How did you get involved in MMA or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? He said, I used to watch WWE and I like boxing, and I caught myself watching the Ultimate Fighter. He said, he looks in the camera and says, look, I'm a fight nerd. And I never heard that expression before. Yeah. And I realized I'm a fight nerd.
Yeah.
My dad used to box. My grandfather used to box. I remember listening to the Muhammad Ali. I talk about this a lot, John. The Muhammad Ali, George Foreman fight, 1974, in my kitchen with my brother. And my dad was at the closed pay-per-view somewhere watching it. And he took us to the Duran-Leonard fight. First fight down at Civic Arena in Pittsburgh. I don't know. I was going to ask you. I don't know if you and I ever went to a closed circuit. Didn't we see the David Moore Duran?
We saw We saw Hagler Hearns.
We saw Hagler Hearns.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Together. Because I know you and I think.
So exciting.
That's how we hooked up, I think, a little bit in college, is we were both sort of secret fight nerds because you liked the boxing. And
of course.
When we ever talk about boxing, we both lit up. And I think that sort of was a bonding because we'd always talk about fighting. That was the Hagler year, so much fun.
Yeah.
Leonard year, so much fun.
Yeah.
I saw the Leonard Hearns fight in the Hasty Pudding Club in Harvard. Like, I wasn't going there for the events. I was going there for the boxing match, you know.
I brought Reggie Davis over to Rosendale at Jerry McIsaac's house, and we sat down with the room crammed like 30 people into a tiny room and watched Leonard Hearns.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that is, I think, the fall of 81 that fight happened, I think.
Yeah.
It's the absolute heyday of boxing for me, like
Hagler
Hearns, Leonard Hearns, Leonard Hagler,
Leonard Hearns fight. That was
all those
amazing
combinations.
Man.
Then throw Duran in. The only other time that might have been as exciting was the first thing, like you said, Ali, bouts, and that, the only downside is Tyson was a little bit exciting, a little blip to watch him annihilate people,
right?
But Tyson then was great.
The problem is, it's hard if you live through all that. It's hard. Current boxing is hard to get as into. You know?
I haven't really followed so much since the Tyson times, but I have to say I love Tyson. Over the years, he's grown even more because he's a fight nerd. If you ever hear him talk, he loves old fighters. He loves Jack Dempsey. I mean, he's like into the old guys.
They studied
he was watching
the
films.
Yeah.
He's sort of an expert, you know, like an encyclopedia of boxing. So he appreciates the game. He's a fight nerd. Anyway.
Customato is probably the biggest fight nerd of all time. He supposedly had more fight footage than anybody. Yeah.
Wow.
And they would just study film constantly.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So about this, the John Connors film. Are you waiting to see what sort of storylines develop? Is that the way it works?
No, we pretty much have it now.
Oh, you do?
That's what I said. We have 90% of the footage.
They were hoping that I would get eaten by a grizzly bear, but
sending him out. Sending him through some of the dicier parts of town, hoping to get mugged. It's just a story about John, and it's just through the context of the Connors MMA. You know, shout out to Jesse who won. We finally got two big wins. Jesse won big, and Abraham won. It's so much fun watching them.
Exciting.
And they not only did they win, they were applying their jiu-jitsu. So there was a lot of little takeaways for for us to talk about.
It's a great night for us.
Do you want to summarize for anyone who doesn't know? I mean,
so Abraham, if you listen to this podcast, you probably know he's the guy that was robbed in the gas station on the corner here, and the robber punched him in the face a few times, and then Abraham just sprang into action and just brought a fight to this guy that this guy had no idea was coming. You know, that guy woke up that morning and said, I'm going to have an easy day. I'm going to smack some guy and take his money. And the next thing you know, he was just getting manhandled. Yeah.
I like how you said it was like in his mind, he was running the script of I'm going to rob a gas station. And then he was like, and now I'm in an MMA fight.
MMA fight. I've always wanted to be in an MMA fight, but I'm getting my ass kicked. And Abraham choked him unconscious. So essentially, Abraham brought that same intensity and more skills to the cage in Cage Titans. And pretty much, he dominated the guy and finished the guy in the third round, referee stoppage from strikes. But it was such a great performance. He did everything. He did total mixed martial arts. He did several takedowns. He had some submission attempts. He kicked. He punched. He just did it all and with such intensity. And I was thinking about his approach. I mean, he's such a sweet and wonderful guy, so sincere and earnest. You know, he's an immigrant to this country, but I was trying to analyze, why was he so effective? What is it about his psychological approach? And I think he's got an immense amount of gratitude. He's just like grateful to being here, grateful for the academy, grateful for his coaches. So he's got this gratitude underlying everything, and he's got an authentic humility. He's just like, I'm the student, you guys are the coaches, and he's got intense drive. So I think when you have that, when he gets in the cage, there's no space for self-consciousness. He's not thinking, I don't want to look bad. You know, he's just like, I finally got here. I got my chance in the cage. I'm so grateful, and I'm just going to give it everything. And so he's just all about forward and fighting. You know, there's no space for self-doubt and self-consciousness and all this sort of egocentric
and worrying how you look, right? I mean, how you appear to other people.
And then so that bell rings, and man, holy cow, he just brought it with such intensity. He barnstormed. He he just steamrolled his opponent. Like the guy didn't have a chance. You know what I mean? He was getting attacked with such intensity. And with technical skill, too. It wasn't just, you know, brawling. So he just did really wonderful.
He climbed up on the guy's back. I've never seen anybody do that in a cage. Yeah. He climbed up on his back, had him wrapped around his waist with his legs and choking him just on his back. I mean, it was incredible. The guy's like, what the hell is this? Know this move. I mean.
Yeah, it was really impressive. I was very happy for him. You know, you never know what's going to happen when somebody gets in the cage. Like, he's a very dedicated athlete, but you just don't know. And, man, he had a perfect performance. I don't think he could have performed better. And, you know, it's even better than winning in the first round because you get your experience. You get 2.5 rounds of fighting in. I think it was – did he finish him?
It was the third round.
And he clearly won both rounds, the first and the second, you know.
And for, the film, we're excited because, like, moments like that, John, we get John coaching. We have him mic'd up. Like I said, the Cage Titan Mike Povera has been really wonderful letting us have access. So we get to hear John coaching in between the rounds, which is good.
Have you heard any of the footage or seen any footage?
I have, yeah. Yeah.
Is it weird to see?
Very weird. We did a little showing. Was that in the fall, Mark?
Yeah, in New York, yeah.
With our other college roommates in a room much like this, maybe a little larger room.
A conference room, right?
And it was up on a small screen. Yeah, I felt a lot of different feelings. It was, I don't even know how to describe it. You know, I felt subconscious. I felt proud. I felt embarrassed. I felt everything. Yeah.
Do you get used to a little? Because I think even this podcast, you know, episodes 1, 2, 3, like I almost is unbearable to listen to yourself. Like I felt. Yeah. And then past that, you just get used to it.
Get used to it.
Go, all right.
Yeah, I think my nature is somewhat introverted. I was very shy as a kid. So when we first started this program, this film, I think we went over to Harvard. And Sasha's a wonderful cinematographer.
World class.
Yeah, such a great guy. He had me standing on the bridge, Charles River Bridge at Harvard, and he's like filming me, just stand there. So I felt like this lost class. You know what I mean? I'm like pretending to be a male model or something. You know what I mean? And he's
the Connors collection.
He's kind of a perfectionist. He wants a certain look. So you're just not there for 10 seconds. You're there for a while. Now look this way, look that way. And it's in the middle of the day and people are walking by you and everything. And,
And they must be looking over like, why is he being filmed?
And then you're trying to stand there looking natural. And
did he tell you was he like look brooding?
Not so much that, but they may, you know, I think some of it is just about lighting and color and direction and things like this.
When I say, John, can I give you some acting tips? He says, fuck you. Every time. That's all he says.
No, Zoran doesn't want any acting.
Zoran wants to have you to be yourself, which is the best way.
But you can't act.
If this film's going to be good, there almost has to be things where you
I
look
think
bad,
I have
right?
to. Yeah.
We can't just like a boring, more boring film is. John's
oh, we got
Academy
plenty of that
and
in there.
Everyone won, and everyone won their fight, and everything
it's
is
not
great.
It's not a John Connors
and everyone,
MMA promo.
And look how great! And because we recently said there was a year in the Academy where it was just an insane level of victories. It might have been before the filming, right?
Yeah.
Like neither of us can remember, but it was like. In MMA and jiu-jitsu went like 18-1 or 24-2 or, you know, some insane. But if you make the film, I would think that's like, look, we always win. What a success. Like that's not as compelling as ups and downs.
You need tension. You need dramatic tension. Right.
But with their ups and downs for you, John, you have to, the downs are on film, right? Like, and you have to, you know, it's not always fun to watch or to.
I tell you what it does, Dan, is, it pushes you out of your comfort zone and it also makes you be vulnerable and realistic, which actually ultimately strengthens you. You know what I mean?
I could see that.
Yeah. So I've had a lot of that. Yeah. And you feel it. You're like, my life is on film here. Holy cow. Yeah. So it makes you want to probably be a better version of yourself too, you know?
Yeah. But it also makes you deal with those things, you know, negative things. And you're like,
You can't. Yeah. They're harder to brush under the rug. Yeah. They're there.
Or go into denial or pretend it didn't happen or whatever.
Yeah. Which is ultimately a better way to live is to not go into denial. So, it's been an amazing experience for me. Just, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with the film, but I think it has altered the course of my life.
Is there an end goal for the film? Like how long it's going to be and what you want to do with it? Or is that sort of up in the air, like however it sort of plays out?
No, we have a plan. We want it to be like a feature length. So get it in festivals and do the traditional route, but now I can look at other untraditional things with TV booming. So we'll see. But we have to get it to one more stage, an investor's cut, and that'll be done by July, August. And then we'll be able to see who's interested and who's willing to put up the final funds to finish it. We've been able to gather funds, thank God, from friends and people who are interested to get to this stage where now we have a pre-cut, rough cut that will be an investor's cut. So
summer, it's going to start, decisions are going to start being made.
Yeah. Zoran and I, our goal is to make a film that we both like. That was like, let's just make a film that you and I like, Zoran.
It's kind of like this podcast. We just make something that Dan and I like. Yeah. And Dimitri hates it, but he allows us to keep coming back, and we like it. Yeah. I always leave here, and I don't know how the episode was, and then I listen to it a week or two later, and I'm always pleasantly surprised. I'm like, that was pretty good. I like that.
Except unlike you, we have no plan.
We got no plan.
having fun.
I wanted us to, you know, honor the fight crowd and the fight nerds. So I think from in my mind, we got at least 12 fights are going to be in there, 8 live, and then we're going to be going over other people's fights that they had before that had an impact on their life. So there's going to be a lot of action, and then but it's not all about the action. It's the weaving in John's life and what we all learn from these things, these people's experiences. They become like the teaching points, you know.
Right. So these aren't not as an exhaustive list, but who are, it sounds like Tyler's in it and Jesse's in it.
Tyler has a fight. Yeah, Jesse has a fight.
We got some of the jiu-jitsu tournaments that we did last year.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow we're going to be at the Boston Open. Mark's going to be at the Boston Open.
Right, there's quite a few people there. Yeah. Rory, you said.
Mm-hmm. Ciampa was in a couple. Will had a fight.
Right.
And Abraham. And then Matt Tulas, his fights, the one with the Russian, I can't wait to see. I've never seen that one. The one that he got out wrestled, I guess, by that Russian guy in the second pro fight, which seems to be a pretty pivotal moment in his life. And that guy's in the UFC now. That's what I think is interesting. The guy
fighter,
who's beat Matt, he's in the UFC. The guy who beat Jesse Branch became a great, you know.
He's beast too.
Pretty high level. So these guys have been measured against some of the best. So it's legitimate with the skills. Their experience. Yeah, so we'll see. It's dedicated to the fight nerds, so look out for the crowdfunding too, because we are going to do just a small crowdfunding, but it's just more promotional than we need the money. We're going to try to raise money for the editor who's doing this last cut. We want to be able to pay him. We'll announce that in May.
Yeah, it's very funny, Dan. I've also become, well, of course, Mark and I are old friends, but we've become even closer on this project than the other guys on the project, Zoran and Sasha. I've become so close to them, with them, just going on all these misadventures. You know, filming is a lot like the fight game. You have a plan and you show up and you never know what the hell's going to happen. You know, there's so many contingencies, bad weather, all kinds of things can happen. It's so.
Our first fight, the guy almost got drug tested right there.
Oh, right.
It was like they said no. And then all of a sudden they go
cancel the fight, like. Right, minutes before, hours before the fight, and you know you're bringing in people and equipment, and you're investing a lot to capture a moment, and then they're telling you, yeah, that moment's not going to happen. So it's very stressful, and you have to improvise.
You got to capture the moment of the moment not happening, and then maybe there's some drama not happening. You know, like
and this crew, these guys are persistent. On Sasha. They've been doing it for decades, so they've worked together, and they're great friends. So there's a chemistry that they have, and they have this lightheartedness. And a seriousness, like they are really dedicated to making something great, but they can laugh at each other at all the moments that go wrong, you know? And so I've been all over the world with them at this point. I've been Tokyo, I've been California, New York, everywhere. So I'm kind of feeling that when all the work gets wrapped up, I'm going to go into a depression. It's going to be a big letdown.
What was your own competitive experience part of the film too?
We got the Pan Am game.
Right.
So you run around and, you know, they see, and they're sensitive guys, they're artists. So, you know, when I'm with Tyler and we're behind backstage before he goes out to the fight and it's like 95 degrees and 100% humidity and Tyler's pacing and he's going to go fight the Iranian Greco world champion. Like, this guy's just a monster, and the tension, you know, and they're rooting for him too. They don't know what's going to happen, you know. It's one thing when you see a video of a fight that's happened. It's such a pale shadow of the real experience. Yeah. Like, the real moment before they go out there to go in that cage It's indescribable.
I think there's two things that people don't know. One is if you know the outcome already, it's completely different. Right. Like, I think I heard Abraham won before I watched and Jesse won before I watched this last weekend.
Yeah.
All the tension's basically gone.
Yeah.
Because, and people don't realize that that if you don't know, you're like, any second they can be knocked out.
Exactly.
And part of that, I mean, it sounds like an obvious point. They're like, well, of course we know that. But if it's someone you know personally.
Right.
The intensity is so much more. Like, you can root for someone on TV, like, oh, I hope he wins. And there's some nervousness. But if it's like someone you actually know, or in your case, trained and coached, and you're ringside, the tension is through the roof, because any second, especially in MMA, but to some extent in boxing as well, you're like, this could just end against me any second, right? Like, any second, every time they throw a haymaker, you're like, if that
could go, it could go bad, really bad. Yeah, they could just get hurt, concussed, and beat up badly.
You talk about that, the mixed feelings of seeing, being on there, hearing the smack, because you're hearing the smacks when they're hitting.
When you're right there, you feel the weight when they stomp on the, you just feel it and you hear it, that when you watch in video, you just don't get the sensation of the same power, the same danger, like you said, the tension. Even if you don't know the outcome, you just can't feel it the same as when you're cage side and it's somebody that you know and you care about that's in there.
And especially because, you know, you can't, the fighters don't intentionally don't react to shots. So sometimes you don't even know anything happened when you're watching. When you're sitting there, you're like, man, he really just got hit a body shot or something that you, on TV, you might not be able to really tell.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think that affects judging too, because the judges see or feel huge impacts that a guy at home can't see or feel.
Throw a big punch. And the fighter leans back a little bit, and it'll hit the shoulder, and it'll make a loud noise and a loud thud. And people think it hit him on the chin, and they go, whoa. And it really didn't have much effect on the fighter at all, because he just took it on his shoulder. So, yeah, sometimes that happens. You're right.
So I had another thought, though, about when this gets released, and you hope it goes, you know, as big as possible. Speaking of getting out of your comfort zone, the larger the audience, the more negative feedback you're going to get, for sure. No matter what is produced, no matter what is in that film, there's going to be that angry mob internet crowd. The larger the audience, the larger that mob, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, a certain percentage of people are just in the business of poking holes and criticizing stuff online. You know, I don't know what percentage, 1% of everybody online is just a complete ass, and you're going to get that. It's unavoidable.
Maybe 1% of people, but online,
it's higher. Yeah, maybe.
I think a lot higher.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing's loved by everybody. You know, it's like there's nothing that's ever been produced.
Well, that's true, but there's some people that are just in the business of not liking.
Right.
So it doesn't matter what it is.
Well, the internet really is something about it. Online, it brings out people that they just like to rip on people.
Yeah, it's empowering for them.
Rip on either the project or on you or on the fighters or on anyone in it. They just like it, you know. We always said with this podcast, if it expands out, you're going to get people saying how much they hate me, how much they hate you, how much they hate the podcast. Like, you just can't avoid it, right?
Well, I can see them saying that they would hate you, but let's not get carried away.
I don't care.
And we're trying to be as vulnerable as possible in this film. I'm trying to, like, tell those guys, just show it, show all of it. I don't, you know, that's part of the process of getting outside the comfort zone. It's just like, yeah, here it is, man. This is it.
Honesty really comes off on camera. The camera picks up authenticity, honesty. So we have to just be as real and come back to just...
I mean, I think that's the only path to an interesting film anyways.
Anyway, you know? Especially a documentary. Yeah. Just be as real as you can. And just, like we said, we want to like the movie, Zoran and I. And then we're thinking John will like it. You know, if we won't
care.
Right,
it sounds literally like you're not interested in it being trite or simple, or, you know, just sort of like...
No, and we don't have any particular philosophy that we're shoving down people's throats and making the film for that. It's very exploratory. It's kind of like, what's John thinking about? Where's the film going? What's happening? I'm at a loss. I don't know what the hell it's about.
And that's the balance, because, you know, John does explain things well. When he's talking, he's a teacher, but that doesn't come off good on, you know, on camera. It's so much. You have to get it in small doses and get it right with the right image to make it interesting.
Isn't that editing?
Captivating. Yeah, the editing's important.
Editing is huge.
Just
right?
real quick, I just want to say the crew you're talking about, Zoran, Sasha, Rade's our editor. Sasha's the cinematographer. Zoran's the director and co-producer with me. They're all Serbian. They're all from Serbia. And they all worked at a television station for years in Serbia. And they worked together on Zoran's project because he was a famous film director in Yugoslavia. And had 5 big hits there I think two of his films, like the top of the year, they came out, top attendance. And then when the Yugoslavian war happened, they fled to the States, became refugees here. And then Zoran became a film professor at Manhattan School of Visual Arts. Roddy became editor, and Sasha, cinematographer. I think Sasha and Zoran worked at a German television studio in New York City for a lot of years and did hundreds of documentaries, just quick weekly shows. So that's, they got a lot of chops in there. We talked about getting skills.
I think Zoran, I don't know if Zoran or Sasha told me these, the German TV, basically, in Germany, the view of Americans are, we're just nutty people. So the whole theme of it was to go find nutty people in the United States and make a little show about it. So the one show was nudist canoers in Delaware, I think.
Yes.
So, and of course, like most nudists, they're the most unattractive bodies you've ever seen in your life. So they were telling me some story. I wish I had the details better, but they were like on the water in a canoe all freaking day, and like they're trying to do the sound and the cameras. It's just a horrible thing, and it was just a day of complete frustration. And then at the end of the day, Zoran turned to Sasha and said, "But it's a good story, at least." Nudist canoers.
So this is a very different. You're not. The idea here wasn't like, let's find someone.
Well, I think the idea was they cut their teeth. They've done so many things under so many conditions that you build an expertise that way. Mm-hmm.
But there's still the common thread of unorthodox, right? Like the unorthodox people and unorthodox success.
Yeah.
And
you meet some really interesting people in those weirdo places who are genuine and nice people and got their together, but they're just quirky. And these
well, MMA Jim is kind of unorthodox, weird sort of people. We've had that conversation before.
Who's that?
Too.
MMA guys?
I mean, it seems like, for me, knowing the guys in the gym, they all seem like real normal crowd, right?
They're
like
all intelligent, from all
sensitive, sorts of,
like, yeah, you
it
know,
seems that
thinkers.
Way.
Thinkers.
I think,
but
you
there
need
is a there's something there that's weird to be in that gym, right?
Well,
like if you're in that gym, it's weird, right? Like it's
well,
only,
you need a certain
less than 1% that does it. So.
Yeah, you need a certain openness. You have to be open to experience to a certain degree. And I find those are the most interesting people in the world anyways, people that are open to experience. When somebody's very closed and like, I do it this way, you know, I'm an accountant, a CPA, and I wear these conservative clothes, super conservative, not open, it's a little less interesting
and
for
open
me.
And to discomfort,
you know?
As well.
But there's a line in the documentary. Yeah. You're like, someone pressed you on that, and you're like, why do they come in my gym? Why are they coming into the MMA gym? If they're open, they're sensitive, this kind of guy's like, they want to be a badass.
Yeah.
At some point, if you're going to go to an MMA gym or a Brazilian jiu-jitsu and try to get good at that, you're either a little angsty or you want to be a badass, or you kind of think that you have something that you want to kind of show or display or take on.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more intense in modern day fighters than getting in a cage. You know, like the old days was boxing. Maybe a boxing ring in Thailand where the Muay Thai guys are getting in. That I'll put that up there too. And then the cage in the MMA. I mean, there's no other. It's the highest arena, right, for fighting in this world.
I think so. Yeah.
So
yeah, you're saying why do you walk through that door?
Right.
It's an interesting question, right? There's different answers, but
pretty
you touched on
extreme thing. It's extreme sport.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys will say, "Oh, I'm looking to lose weight and get in shape and do something interesting." That's not it. That's the rational cover story that's covering the, I want to feel like a badass. You know what I mean?
And I think it changes. I don't think.
Yeah, I think you come in that way. That's how I came into the sport.
That's the profound thing about the movie, Dan, is what you see how it all changes. You get into the art. I'm watching these guys get into the art of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and that takes your head away, even from the MMA and from the fighting. You're figuring out this eternal Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
And you're learning about yourself. There's a lot of self-discovery. And then there's a lot of, it's never over. You're always going to challenge yourself. There's something new to learn. It's just always engaging your mind. And then you get the camaraderie of you have a great place, good people. The community around there is strong. So it just adds that whole environment piece that people so desperately need today, just to be an environment of like-minded people. No one's going to bug you. You're all in the same purpose. You understand each other on a very good level. And then it just sort of grows from there.
Yeah,
but yeah.
I think you nailed it, Mark.
Yeah, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu artistry really has gotten me. I'm really appreciating it.
Yeah.
You know, like when Jesse's fight, he was on top a lot, and like you were saying, if you didn't know a lot about Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you wouldn't see that he was doing a lot, even though you couldn't tell he was doing a lot. He was holding that big guy down, but he was always working for a move, right, going for the shoulders. Now I see a little bit, the intricacy is amazing. And focus, the concentration you have to get there. I mean, it's amazing. Get a submission.
Yeah. I think people underestimate the skill involved. There's a lot of like, why didn't he get up? And it's like, you try it.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, or it's like, oh, he just held him down. It's like, you try it. You try to hold that guy down. He'll be up in 1 second if you try to hold, you know what I mean? That guy would get up literally in 2 seconds. He will be up if you try to hold him down. Because they don't see that there's skill involved in it. They're like, he's just holding him down. He's just punching him. And
a lot of technique.
He wrestled.
Yeah.
Guy was built like a Hulk. I mean, he's unbelievable. And he strained with every muscle in his body. You're watching him. He had his legs spread. He got the perfect base. And he just was driving into his hips to keep that guy against the cage. Or when he had him on the ground, he had to keep everything precisely where he needed it or wanted it. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. Great performance.
The effort he put in. Was
very happy for Jesse McGillicott. Yeah, great performance.
He's the hippie badass. That's what Pedro said. One badass hippie.
That's funny.
Shout out, Jesse.
You think that was Pedro or is it Chad? That sounds like Chad would say that. Chad
liked that. I saw it on one of your Facebook things.
Maybe it was Pedro. I don't know. Right. Yeah.
And jiu-jitsu, the other interesting thing is it's maddening, too. This same idea of like the never-ending puzzle. I remember when I first started, someone, I can't remember exactly who it was, some gym owner that was, but he said, it's like, picture it as like a video game that you can never, ever finish or win. And I was like, that sounds horrible.
I'm out.
I'm out. Yeah, exactly. But that is sort of true. Like, not everyone does this, but I'm someone who does it where I'll just be like, oh, I hate jiu-jitsu. Like, there's times I'm just like, I can't. Like, because you have repeated failure. The idea of there's always something to learn is you're always not successful at something. You know, you're always having days that you underperform and you're always going, why was I so bad today?
Well, I think there's another phenomenon happening, Dan, is as an individual you're improving and progressing, but it seems like the whole art is moving forward too. So the guys that are blue belts now are way better than I was when I was a blue belt, you know? So just because there's more information out there through the internet and there's more opportunity to train. So if somebody trains twice a day, 6 days a week, they're going to get good fast, you know? And if you're training 3 or 4 times a week, you're not going to grow at the same rate. It's just not possible. So like the whole base of athletes are moving the whole sport up. It's just like, remember when we were kids, we would watch Evel Knievel. He would get on a motorcycle, go over 3 buses, crash and break both his legs. Yeah. And we were like, wasn't that amazing? Yeah. And now these guys go over 17 buses, they get off the bike, they get back on the bike,
flip around
a bunch of times, and they land without a scratch.
They plane out up there. They hold on to the handlebars and plane their body on top of the bike.
You know, everything evolves. These sports evolve, and I think jiu-jitsu is evolving as well.
Yeah, we said even the public.
Just in case you weren't discouraged enough, Dan,
it's only going to get worse, is what you're saying.
Failure piece you brought up is really important. It's come up so much in the movie because we had some losses, you know. So we're like, okay, how do we deal with the failure, the loss? And then it becomes the whole philosophy. What's really a loss? When did you lose? Can you learn from your loss? If you learn from a loss, was it really a loss? So metaphorically, what's a loss and what's a win and how to turn the losses into victories and how when you win, it's not – sometimes it's a loss because you're going to bring a lot of stuff on to your life, either an ego or pressure or complacency. So
I think part of the film might be about this ongoing process of moving forward back into the challenge zone, moving forward out of your comfort zone repeatedly, no matter what happens.
And I should say that MMA is really ideal for that because compared to boxing, like we talked about boxing, these boxers were 36-0, you know, or like they would all be, Hagler Hearns would be fighting and be like, they're both 30-1 or 28-0. I don't know the exact records, but in boxing, you'd have these massive, massive win streaks. And no one, almost no one has it in MMA because you can't.
I think they started in boxing to cultivate people and sort of set them up with manageable, winnable fights to get that momentum going, which is probably a decent strategy. You know, you can overdo that perhaps too.
MMA never had that culture though, right?
They're starting to do it now a little bit, I think, Dan. And I heard that some of the, one camp in particular in Brazil used to do that. So these guys would be 28-0, but they really hadn't fought 28 right. Super tough competitors. I don't know.
In MMA of all time, legends that are 18-12, and you know what I mean.
Yeah. Like they, but that know, that's admirable in my mind. Yeah, they're not hiding, and it's a more complicated sport. Like Mayweather, he's undefeated. He's pretty much seen it all. He gets in the ring, nothing can surprise him. He's seen it all and internalized it all several times over.
Right. Well, he has a strategy that in boxing that people can't crack, but
right.
that's what's impossible in MMA because you'd have to have that for wrestling and boxing and
yep.
that's and Muay Thai.
There's so many more factors.
Jiu-jitsu.
Like yeah.
To have an impregnable defense against all of those things is seemingly almost impossible.
I think so. And the sport's still evolving. And boxing's been around for such a longer period of time that, you know, I think somebody like Mayweather can know almost all that's knowable in the sport. So, yeah, he can be undefeated. At some point, though, he can't be. You know, he's going to age and his skills are going to deteriorate. So I don't know if he's going to hang around long enough for that. Who knows?
It seems like he's going to bow out. So
yeah. So, Mark, Dan is undefeated against muggers. He's been attempted
yeah,
muggings
on the
in New York and Florida and Paris. All over the world, muggers have been completely stymied by him. So I'm wondering, have you ever been mugged?
I consider it a mugging, even though it wasn't really violent. It was basically just a guy who just...
Where was this?
It was in New York City in the evening. Like maybe 3 a.m. in front of my stoop. Just in, came, stops, and give me your money.
In Brooklyn or Bronx? Where were you?
I was in the East Village.
East Village.
Manhattan.
And what happened?
So you were sitting on your stoop at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, listening to music and...
Were you listening to a boombox?
It was a little. It was just a little radio. Like, yeah, he would have took the boombox.
As a quick aside, so some people are like, why have you had these run-ins? And I'm like, well, I mean, if you're out, the thing is to be out in a city after like 1 a.m.,
yeah.
is when these things happen, right. you know, generally.
Yeah.
Although,
like they say, what is that famous say? Yeah, nothing good happens at 3 a.m.
I mean, almost right. all of mine were after 1 a.m. Not the one from when I was 15, but Florida, Paris, another New York one. Like, they were all late.
So, Mark, you're in your mid to late 20s. How old are you?
Yeah, late 20s.
Late 20s. You're in the East Village.
It was pretty simple. He just basically stopped. He stopped, smiled. He's like, strikes a cigarette, looks at me. He's like, this is a punk. Some big
guy,
kind of Latino kind of guy. Looks like he had a leather jacket, like a biker gang. And he just thought, like, all right, this is an issue situation. So he looked at me. I looked at him. And then,
could you run in the door?
Was
behind you?
No, it was locked. It was up there. It was because you got two doors to get in.
The
your
outer
thing.
Door, yeah.
Yeah. So I just was stuck, and I'm like, okay. Then what I did was I said, "You got a light?" Because he struck a cigarette. And I'm like, oh, can I have a light? At that point, I was smoking spliffs anyway. So I strike out my spliff, and I figured maybe I broke the ice. Maybe he'll think I'm cool or funny. And he just looks at me and says, give me your money. And I'm like, all right. And I only had $6, luckily, so I just gave it to him, and he walked off. And that was it. And then it's funny, months later, I saw him going for loose change. Like, he was just bumming for loose change. Big guy, but he...
Where?
On First Avenue, going up and down. He was hitting people up for loose change. So he was obviously a street guy. But he looked like he had come on hard times. He looked a little thinner.
Huh.
Either he had a drug addiction or he
should've
got really
sick. Should
have
just punched him right in the face.
Blindsided him.
I didn't want to deal with him. I learned that energy, I wanted to go past me all the time. Any kind of that energy enters my life, I wanted to keep going. So I just kept going. But I thought that was funny that
so
I was
So you got a
him.
Sense that the universe... had doled out a tiny bit of justice, maybe. Cause
yeah,
because
he looked real cocky when he was standing in front of me that night.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe your $6 bought the drugs.
What's that?
Maybe your $6 bought the drugs that put him right down.
Put him over the edge.
It was like, you won the
That's
long
where
run.
The spiral downward started.
He was in the rain. Like, he didn't have a good rain thing. He had like a plastic bag. So he was now drenched, and he had a little coffee cup. And told people
snatched
putting nickels in it.
Snatch the plastic bag.
Thought that was pretty wild.
Wet in the rain. Maybe I'm a little more vindictive.
I forgave. I try to
forgive.
Good
for you, man. You're a good man, Mark.
Yeah, I'm not a big forgiver.
But other than that, just a lot of scams. No real muggings, thank God. No one's ever... My wife got mugged.
If you had more than $6, do you think you would have resisted? Or like, say,
I might have bolted and ran. I was pretty fast. If I had...
Mark's fast, for sure.
If I'd have had between 20 and 40, I would have ran. Six was a tax, almost a street tax I was feeling.
Yeah, I could see $6 being like, all right.
Right.
Evening stupidity. Shouldn't have been out there on a Saturday night in Manhattan.
That was your fee for not running.
That was my fee.
You can sit here and not run for $6.
Got to weigh those things out in the city.
Yeah.
You know, these cost
for sure,
benefit analysis.
He could not have caught you if you ran.
No, he could not have caught me. No.
Yeah.
So if you, after you gave him the money, did you just keep smoking? Like were you just like, well, that was that?
And
like,
no, I tried to play it real cool. He walked away. Then I just jetted into my apartment
you
very fast, kicking myself. Like, you want to add, dummy. What a dummy. Shouldn't have been out there. What I was thinking. Like I was on some late night movie or something.
Do you have any thought when you saw him like swatting his change cup to the ground or just no revenge?
He was a thuggish looking guy. So when you're looking at him holding that change thing out, it's not the guy you're going to want to swat. He had a pretty thick jaw, pretty thick head. You would, guy you wouldn't want to punch in the head.
I've seen that. I was getting ice cream once with my kids were little. And there was a guy, he was like a big muscle bound kind of guy. And he was going down the line of people waiting for ice cream saying,
where's this, Dan?
In New York again, Manhattan. Uh-huh. And he was like,
and you were with your kids?
Yeah. And he's like, can you give me money? Can you give me money? And
shaking like, you down.
And the thing is, they were like women by themselves and he'd hulk over them sort of.
Yeah.
And be like,
kind of obnoxious.
Hey, give me some money. And they'd be scared and they'd give it to him. I was like, it's sort of like a mugging. Like it's sort of.
Yeah.
Right. And he got to me and I did like a normal like, no, sorry, man. And he was like, what do you mean, sorry, man? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, what? He was like,
what do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
This, by the way, Mark, this is Dan's strategy. He repeats back to them what they say in a confused manner, and it completely baffles them.
It works. It happened a few times where a guy.
He's done it in multiple languages. He did it in France this way, too. What? Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, it does work a little bit. Well, I guess sitting there, though, you're stationary, it's not so easy. But John's referring to a guy, like, for example, one guy said, like, hey, give me your wallet. And I was like, give you my wallet. Like, I kept walking and I was like, what? Give you what? Like, and I kept walking and he was like, stop. Give me. I was like, stop. Give you a wallet. And I walked away from him. He got thrown off.
So the ice cream guy.
Yeah. So
says, what do you mean?
Guy. He goes, what do you mean? And I'm like, what do you mean? That one I was actually annoyed. I'm
a little indignant.
And that was more recent. I'd already trained a little. Like, and I was like, I'm not scared of the guy. You know, like, I just got so angry that he would be like I said, I did the new normal thing of going, sorry, man, I can't help you. And he's like, what do you mean you can't help me? You know, like, and I'm like, wait a minute. Like, don't, you're the one asking for money.
Yeah.
Like, don't like
why
now
am I indebted
push
to
me.
You?
Like, and he was like, seemed angry.
Yeah.
And I was like,
well, that's a tactic when, anger.
I was kind of pissed off at the guy that one time. And then, but then he went down, you know, these women standing there and he's like doing the same thing angrily. And I considered like sort of standing up to him or tell him get out of here, leave him alone, but I didn't. I didn't. You never know there, right? Like you never know if the woman be like.
I think if you were
like you would yell
if you were hungover, you would have did something.
Yeah, maybe.
Isn't that your superpower when you're hungover?
One worked at the airline.
You're more irritated, so you.
That's when I got my first class ticket because I was hungover.
Exactly.
I yelled at a guy was bothering the woman at the counter at an airline, and I was hungover, so I start yelling at the guy, leave her alone. And so she gave me a first class ticket.
Wow.
It was like
some appreciation.
There's a lesson there. You should probably be hungover.
It just made you just cranky enough to engage him.
Yeah. Oh, we have another question. I forgot. I'm supposed to give you this question in advance, Mark. This is like our deep question that we ask every guest, but we usually forget.
So I think we've only, how many have we remembered? We remembered like twice.
So what truth do most people disagree with you on? Did I say that correctly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a hard one to go out of the box. But
something that's something true.
You believe.
Something
sense.
You hold to be true.
You believe, but most people
but most
disagree
people,
with you.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to think about that.
All right. We'll get back to you for the next podcast episode.
That I know is true, but they'll disagree with me.
Most people disagree with you. Yeah.
That one takes, I think I'd need some preparation.
Yeah.
Could you answer it? You could off the top of your head, but you thought up the question, so.
I didn't think of the question. It came from Peter Thiel. That was one of his questions that I think he would hit people with that are interviewing with him.
Yeah. But I remember you asked me at once, we were like sitting in a bar and I thought of a bunch of answers. And like right now, I can't think of it.
Right now, I can't either. One of the answers I have is I'm starting to believe that genes have a much bigger influence on people than most people think. Most people think either you're a blank slate and you're all a product of cultural conditioning or parental raising, or they think, it's some combination, a little bit of your genes, but I'm thinking it's your genes probably have a larger impact than most people think.
I agree with that. It's not a balance. I think there is a both, but it's more genes. It's like slanted definitely towards the genes.
Yeah.
Can I go to the restroom?
I think we're all about wrapped up here, man. So
just hold this for an ending? Or?
Yeah. We'll drag it out and keep you in pain.
Yeah. It's jiu-jitsu. Exactly.
You got to get that bladder out of its comfort zone. Your bladder's never going to grow. If you think about it, that is true,
that's
right?
It's never going to stretch out unless
it's never
going to
stretch
experience.
Out unless you sit there with a completely full bladder. Yeah, I think we're good. All right. thank you for coming
thanks.
In, buddy.
Thank you very much.
We'll have to have you back with updates on this film.
Everybody look out for the Connors MMA film and the crowdfunding.
Yeah. I think Mark's hoping.
When would they first see it? There would be crowdfunding in the near future.
Probably May, June. And then we're hoping for January would be really great. If we could,
like a final cut.
This final cut, we could be ready to people to view it in January. That would be
amazing. Mark's hoping for that and my tragic death to make the film more interesting.
It wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
It would not hurt.
Shootout like Alcatraz.
So you're saying if you had a meeting and you were like, well, we have no really good ending, and then you found out John died tragically, would there be some part of you that was like,
there'd be some high five.
I'm sad. Yeah. I'm sad, but on the other hand.
Yeah, it would be sad.
On the other hand.
Just have a picture.
Well, that's all good, man. That's great. Thank you for coming in, Mark.
It's been fun getting our friendship deep again, too.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
Just keep it going, but in each other's space, because like Mark said, we don't see friends and family as much as we'd really like to. Mm. So thank you. It's been great to be part of your life. And everybody at the gym has been awesome, so thanks.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks, Dan. It was nice.
Sure.
Thank you, Dan, for another amazing episode. You're a brilliant podcaster. I really appreciate it. And folks, so rate and review and share this. And like Dan says, you know, what does it take to hit the like button? Never mind the share, right? I think we got 7 likes on the last episode I put up on Facebook. 7. That's outrageous. That's insulting, right?
It's like less than 1 in 10 people.
I don't know. But please hit the like and also share and tell your friends about it. And we'll see you next week. Thanks so much.